where new attractions were developed in conditions of top secrecy. In stark contrast to the theme park cast members, Imagineers cultivated and flaunted eccentricity. While some looked like refugees from a 1950s sitcom, others had long hair, ponytails, facial hair, and earrings. In one case, so many that the Imagineer's earlobe was distended almost to his shoulder. Their leader was Marty Sklar, a former publicist for Walt, whose long tenure and close ties to the master gave him immense stature within Disney. With the Epcot theme park finished and $300 million over budget, the Imagineers had been targeted for extinction by the previous regime, and it was true that much of their work could be subcontracted more cheaply. When Eisner and Wells arrived, Sklar and his team were at work on a new water ride, in which guests would ride logs down a hurtling flume, culminating in a thrilling drop down a waterfall. Dick Nunes had asked for a water attraction, the kind of ride growing in popularity at amusement parks all over the country, but had balked at the proposed $80 million cost. But Eisner loved the scale model of the water chute and urged Sklar and Nunes to go forward. Frank and I often favored the more creative and costly solution to the problem, Eisner later said, which coincided perfectly with the attitude of the Imagineers, who had long been criticized for ignoring budgets. Sklar showed Eisner the early models for Disneyland and Disney World, took him into the archives, and regaled him with stories of Walt's and Roy's often contentious relationship. Eisner was blown away, as he put it. The possibility of more theme parks was already in his mind. The Imagineers had saved their very existence. In contrast to his excitement over the Imagineers projects, Eisner was dismayed when he saw plans for two new hotels scheduled to be built on Disney World property. He thought they were the ugliest buildings he'd ever seen. They were cheap, bland, boxy slabs, just as bad as the already built Contemporary Resort, a forbidding concrete pyramid that looked anything but contemporary. Determined not to get any further into the hotel business itself, the previous regime had contracted out construction and ownership of the hotels to New York-based developer John Tishman. "We have to get out of this deal," Eisner told Wells. The next day, Eisner and Jane were shopping at Knoll International in the Pacific Design Center for furniture for his new office at Disney. His salesman, who was well-dressed and spoke knowledgeably about architecture and furniture design, impressed him. Eisner turned to his wife. "I'm hiring him to protect me from bad architecture and design," he said impulsively. And he did. Even after learning the salesman had dropped out of college and run away from home at 17 to go to Israel, Art Levitt Jr. became Eisner's personal assistant. Only later did he learn that Levitt was the son of the chairman of the American Stock Exchange and future Security and Exchange Commission chairman. Levitt's mother called Eisner. "I just want to thank you," she said. "We've been so worried about Art." Eisner wasn't sure where he'd developed such a keen interest in architecture, but it appealed to his imagination and artistic sensibilities. His parents had hired noted architect Robert Stern to design their new apartment when they downsized by selling the Park Avenue co-op where Michael and his sister had grown up. His parents were also friends of the noted contemporary art collectors Victor and Sally Gans, and the Ganses had treated Eisner to a whirlwind tour of classical architecture during a visit to Rome when he was 18. He often stopped to admire two Manhattan classics of modernism, Mies van der Rohe's Seagram